The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Chris Catrone is a college educator, writer, and media artist committed to critical thinking and artistic practice and the politics of social emancipation. He is the former head of the often contrarian Marxist group, the Platypus Affiliated Society, and this is part two of a discussion about the possibility of realizing philosophy, although it also includes some of Catrone's defense of his previous stances on the Iraq War and on Trump. It's Sunday, October 13th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. This week's podcast is available in full for everyone, but our patrons usually get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. They also get access to our History of Communism video series when those come out, interviews with authors for our monthly book club, which this month will feature David Blacker. We're going to pick another title soon. David Blacker's book is What's Left of the World. And pretty soon, our patrons will get access to a new series called Pop the Left, and you'll probably get access to that on occasion as well. So if you're a fan of this podcast, consider becoming a patron. The music you're listening to right now is a theme from the movie Joker. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Catrone and I discuss how to realize philosophy. Well, but back to philosophy, I mean, the question still remains, how do we, two things. How do we not create a new subject that's like us, right? In our own image of, oh yeah, well, we know not to get in each other's business. And we know exactly where the lines are. And we understand the balance of individualism and collectivity. And therefore, here it is. This is our little model. Even if it's not stated, we have it, right? So how do we avoid operating on that basis? But also, how do we make sure that we are overcoming the owl of Minerva? How do we make sure that we have figured out? I mean, even to say this is a contradiction. But how do we figure out the process of putting ideas into action politically? And especially after the failure of the Soviet Union.
Right. So here I will actually respond to you and Ben Burgess, which is, you accuse me of left accelerationism. So let's unpack that and in a sense try to find some foundation for it. You know, in other words, I'm not just going to reject that accusation out of hand, but let's see what that might mean. I think that Marxism, historically, kind of classical Marxism, thought that capitalism itself pointed beyond bourgeois social relations. In other words, overcoming capitalism on the basis of capitalism itself, that kind of formulation, was about how the industrial forces of production, in however constrained and distorted and deformed ways, already pointed beyond the bourgeois social relations. And that all you needed to do was, in a sense, systematically overcome all of the retarding factors on that process. And obviously, capitalist private property in the means of production was the clearest obstacle to that. Namely, why is investment of capital controlled by private investors? Right? And is it really? In other words, a kind of recognition that the state was already intervening in the interests of capital as a whole, as against the individual capitalists, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why Marx and Engels rejected anarchism and thought that the political struggle was at least as important as the social struggle. And in many respects, more important than the social struggle, because the social struggle couldn't really make any headway against capital. It could only, in a sense, train the workers to become revolutionaries. It couldn't actually, I think that Marx puts it, he doesn't use this exact phrase, it's in the inaugural address to the First International, that it's like a drop in the bucket, that labor unions and workers' cooperatives are good because they sort of train the workers to become active, but it's a drop in the bucket in terms of the capitalist economy. Right. And so, and this is his opening salvo against the anarchists. In other words, he knows who he's dealing with in the First International. And so he just says, all these things are good. And of course, we are in favor of them. We're not LaSallians. Right. We don't abjure the social struggles and economic struggles of the workers. But we also know that it's woefully inadequate and that we have to aim at state power. Right. So in that sense, however, we're back to what we were talking about earlier, which is to say, how is it that capitalism pointing beyond bourgeois social relations, primarily the social relations of labor, but also the relations of, capitalist private property and the means of production, how could that be fulfilled politically? Right? And that's the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that I don't think that that's accelerationism.
That isn't. I think we were bringing up accelerationism in the context of your "Why Not Trump?"
Essay. Oh, Trump.
The only understanding I could get from that, and maybe it's what you were doing there, is not that dissimilar to what Marx was doing in the Critique of the Gotha Program. In other words, Trump might lay bare the contradictions in our society, but it's pretty clear to me that that hasn't happened, that things are not clarified by Trump. And
not in a profound way, no. Of course not. And this is – so I'll say about Trump, it's not as if I thought, okay, Trump is going to press capitalism in a way that Hillary would not have. Of course, Hillary is just as much a capitalist politician as Trump. Absolutely. It's not like Hillary was going to be a retarding factor on capitalism. No, not at all. She would have just been a Wall Street politician. I mean, the Democrats are the party of Wall Street. And in some ways, they're more the party of Wall Street than Republicans are under Trump, because Wall Street's not so sure about Trump and about Trumpism. So I was not saying that, Trump will give capitalism the push that it needs, because that was going to happen anyway. Rather, the issue is the Democrat opposition to Trump exposes the rottenness of politics. In other words, it does expose, at least I thought in 2015, because I wrote that a long time ago now, I thought that the mendacity of the Democrats would be exposed. In other words, that I assume Trump would not be very different at the level of policy from Obama.
And it's debatable to the degree to which he is. He's certainly a very, very different on the level of rhetoric than Obama.
And but in practice,
I think the family separations at the border are certainly an escalation. And
it's funny, speaking of accelerationism, because Trump claims that the reason he's implementing the policy more than Obama did is to force Congress to change it. He does say that. He said in other words, maybe Trump is an accelerationist. In other words, that he's going to lay bare the pathology of the immigration system in order to force reform rather than mealy-mouth it the way Obama did.
Yeah, but for Trump, reform is just turning away everyone. I mean,
No. You know that.
Well,
that's
I
not
don't
true,
know. I mean, what does he want? What does he want instead of this?
He wants to get rid of the visa lottery. And he wants a guest worker program. In other words, what's the difference between him and the Democrats? Because they both want the same thing. They want a guest worker program. In other words, they want a triple-tiered instead of a double-tiered labor force. Because there will always be illegal immigrants. So he just wants to, ground down the illegal immigrants more by setting up a tiered legal workforce. And maybe the difference between him and the Democrats is that they would keep the visa lottery and he would get rid of it.
But, I mean, the trouble is with the way it's been understood is a problem of refugees and not even immigrants.
Now, yeah, I mean, I don't know that Trump is well equipped to deal with immigration at this level. In other words, I think that his original approach to immigration was economic. And, you know, I think that when you're dealing with less a migratory workforce and more economic refugees from the collapse of Central America, because obviously the Great Recession hit the world unevenly. It hit the U.S. very hard, but it clearly has hit Central America hard, very hard. In other words, it clearly has just taken the bottom out from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. Right? And, you know, look, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to the Democrat argument, which is that the U.S. destroyed these countries in the civil wars of the 80s, and so now the U.S. should absorb the costs of that destruction. I'm not unsympathetic to that, but you're not going to get people to vote for that.
Right. Well,
and so, you know, let's just get real. Like, that's not a winning strategy for the Democrats, right? Like, in other words, it might be morally correct, but Trump's going to win on that one. I mean, my whole point with Trump is just to say, do you really think that Trump's going to lose on this? Because he's not. In other words, as disgusting as his policies are on immigration, it's a winning issue for him.
But I think if you went at it a different way, rather than a moral argument, if you said, look, the reason why there are these economic refugees is because we are living in a system. You know, I know this is too complex.
Oh, by the way, so Trump has said that he's willing to give aid to Central American countries as long as, and by the way, the Attorney General Barr was just down in El Salvador recently. So they, you know, they are offering these countries aid for their cooperation in restricting migration.
Well, okay, so...
So again, what's the difference? Do you think the Democrats would handle that differently?
Well, I think that they would. I think that they would handle specifically the refugees coming into the country.
But they would also seek to slow it, and they would do it through cooperation with those governments, and they would use aid as a leverage.
Right, and Trump has no problem creating very ugly, immediately inhumane conditions. He doesn't, you know.
No, he doesn't hide it. In other words, Obama hid it. Obama hid it. And, you know, what we're dealing with now is, you know, again, is there a crisis on the border? I guess. Is it a manufactured crisis? I guess. I mean, it's also murky, isn't it? Because what the Democrats accuse Trump of doing is through his rhetoric, he's forcing people to flee Central America because people are trying to get in now before the border is closed. So they think it's a manufactured crisis, not just in terms of his cruelty, but they think his threat to close the border is actually causing a mass migration. And that, I doubt that.
No, I doubt that too. But the, right? The point here, though, is for me, if like when I said he'll just turn everyone away, I meant refugees. You know, I didn't mean all immigrants.
Yeah, he would process them in Mexico instead of in the United States. I guess that's turning them away.
It is because, well, the argument is, and I think it's largely true, is that many of these refugees are in real danger in Mexico. And, you know, if you turn them back into Mexico, if you keep them in Mexico to be processed, a lot of them won't make it through.
Yeah, they'll be taken advantage of. And
or
I mean,
killed.
Look.
I mean, it's really the drug war. I mean, I've watched Breaking Bad. It's very,
yeah. Yeah. It's there. It's real. Yeah. It's, and that, by the way, this is why AMLO doesn't really disagree with Trump all that much. Right. The leftist president of Mexico. Right. He's like, yeah, Trump's right. And yeah, we want to work with him. Now it's all very, like I said, very murky. And, I mean, this is not to alibi Trump. Like I said, it's disgusting policy. And, you know, I neither like the rhetoric nor the action. But what I am here to say is this does not excuse the Democrats at all. Zero. Not at all. And if they go down in flames on the issue, in other words, if the white working class, so-called, says, no, we don't want to pay for refugees, yes, we want law and order at the border, and rebuke the Democrats and say, no, it's not racism to demand law and order at the border, then the Democrats have set themselves up for it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting that that Bernie Sanders and even, like, I think Joe Biden have – And I don't know, actually, maybe Harrison Warren, too. I don't really know. But they've all sort of, I think they've repudiated the open borders position of, like, say, the AOC kind of part of the Democratic Party. You know, they've.
It's unclear whether anyone has an open borders policy, meaning, like, you know, because I'm sympathetic as well to the demand to abolish ICE, meaning, you know, I don't know that it would accomplish very much. And I don't think that ICE should be abolished because the people in ICE are especially racist. But you could make the argument that ICE's mandate is problematic.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, look, I was against ICE when it was formed.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Which is not to say that La Migra, the INS, was better.
No, but ICE was formed very particularly under the auspices of the
Homeland Security.
War on Terror.
Yes, right? Homeland Security, yeah. Yep.
And that was part of a very expansive attack on civil liberties overall.
Yes, absolutely. And this is, of course, something that the right wing, you know, like a Tucker Carlson, like these kinds of people, like the Trumpists, like they're very unclear on that. In other words, they actually think that citizens don't have rights. And it's like, that's not how it works. You know, the Bill of Rights applies to everyone on U.S. soil. Right? Citizen or not citizen. So these right-wing maniacs, like, they're like, oh, citizens have no rights. I'm like, that's actually completely wrong. And Trump doesn't say anything like
that. Well, it's unclear now because they, for the last 20 years, those rights of citizens and non-citizens
have been eroded.
Have completely been eroded. And not just eroded, but attacked. You know, like, hell, Obama didn't even reestablish habeas corpus, you know?
Yes, they've been administratively circumvented in a very flagrant way. And it's a disgusting situation. Like I said, I have no sympathy to the policies or the rhetoric by any means. But the question is, what's on offer? Because I don't even think that AOC, you know, in other words, like maybe these people could be schooled on the issue and maybe they would be for a more thoroughgoing reform. But I think that there's just a lot of anti-Trump point scoring with very little follow through on like actual reform. In other words, how would you guarantee the rights of non-citizens? Right? Like no one's really taking that up. Maybe they just hope the courts will do it. I don't know.
The political moment is such that it's not even being discussed on that level.
And
a large part of the reason it isn't being discussed on that level is Trump. And it's not because of the Democrats' anti-Trumpism. It's because of Trump. It's the way he frames things, the way he blends things together. Like, and just a good example of that is the way he blends the war on drugs with his immigration policy, as if the immigrants are the ones bringing heroin into the country, which they're not. And the other problem, this kind of brings me to back to the ideas versus action problem. It's like, you know, in order to – if a Democrat were to say, look, in order to refute Trump, you're going to have to pay attention. I have to ask the voters to pay attention and have, you know, an attention span and to not worry about whether or not they're bored, because these distinctions matter. And it's not like I'm being, you know, too clever or trying to trick you. It's just like there are real distinctions in the world and they matter. And why don't you pay attention? I mean, that I feel like the anti-Trump candidate would be nasty to everyday Americans like that, you know, like.
Well, I mean, look, there's a difference between that and the kind of Obama neoliberal style technocratic, which is to say, look, the public can't understand, and so they shouldn't be concerned, and so we shouldn't even talk about it. because the public will just get confused if we try to talk about it.
Right. Well, that is the assumption, right? Though. I think that is the assumption not only in the neoliberal technocratic political class, but really across the board on the left as well. I mean,
yes,
you know, and often enough people yes. say, oh, people won't understand when what they're covering up is their own lack of understanding. But
well, because the left is just engaged in sloganeering. Now, but that raises a question, which is to say, you know, I came across a Spartacist League article recently, and they just raised a very basic point. And, you know, I'm not too happy with the condition of the Spartacist League these days, and I've developed a criticism of even their old positions in my, you know, own education and further understanding of Marxism. I see the limitations of their own positions, even their classic old positions that were better. But they just said, look, socialists don't have a positive program for immigration under conditions of capitalism. Socialists have a negative program, and the negative program is full citizenship rights for all workers. If you got here, you have a right to be here, right? But socialists don't have a positive program on getting people here. They only have a negative program on defending those people once they're here.
And what that means is, like, under capitalism, socialists don't have a solution for the problem of immigration.
Yes. Of migration. Migration.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Because the truth is that, you know, migration is a way to keep work. The truth is, overall, workers are competing with each other under capitalism.
On a global level, and people have to go where the jobs are.
I mean, the other way to think of it is to say, what are we going to do with all these people, with these young people that are being born? They're a threat to our working, to our jobs, you know, and they are, you know, young people come up and they replace you.
They're willing to work for less. They're willing to work harder and longer hours.
That's, I mean, the youth are undercutting wages much more than immigrants are.
Oh, sure.
Right.
So in this respect, again, I feel like what the left really is just a kind of hothouse environment in which is incubated future Democrats, meaning the most leftists are unserious. The few who are serious only in the sense of becoming future technocrats. NGO types, you know, policy wonks, you know, in terms of like the political people, right? Even the movement activists, in other words, even the people who aren't just electoralists like AOC and her gang, you know, like her coterie, her boyfriend, her campaign manager, like obviously these are all just aspiring Democrats, right? But like even the people who are not in the electoral arena are just going to be in the civil social NGO arena. No, I mean, it's tricky. So, you know, again, on the Trump front, you know, I just thought this is going to, I thought he was just taking advantage of and therefore expressing a crisis in mainstream politics that existed. And I also thought he's the least worst expression of that, meaning rather than a Ted Cruz style, like ideological, like a Tea Party type guy, that Trump is really just a pragmatist and a moderate and a realist. And, you know, and so if the Republicans are going to be hijacked by crazies, if you will, then the Trump variety is, you know, going to be preferable to some, you know, Ted Cruz, Paul Ryan, Ayn Rand, Christian fundamentalist, like hardcore Reaganism or something that doesn't even understand itself as what it is, like it, that takes itself too seriously, that's more Reaganite than Reagan was. You know, and which is to say, you know, the only reason why Trump would be preferable to that is that it manifests the crisis of the Republican Party. Whereas Cruz and Ryan and those people would mask it in the sense of like staying true to the principles of the Republican Party or something, as opposed to a crisis of that. And, you know, and I do think it necessarily has a spillover effect on the Democrats. In other words, the Democrats are now experiencing their crisis. I mean, they kind of did with Bernie, but not really. Now they really are in it.
Trump is represents a crisis within the Republican Party and in American politics in general, but that it also if Bernie Sanders had won, we would be going in the very similar direction, just with different reasons and hopefully in a more humane way. But there is a drive towards nationalism now, and on the left and the right, and the only people who are resisting it are neoliberals. And so I feel as though the racism in Trump is an expression of a drive towards nationalism, which I think, and I don't have this fully worked out, I can't really back it, but I think is caused by, in a delayed way, by the 2008 economic crisis. So we're reacting to the economic crisis. Every capitalist class internationally is sort of hunkering down. And it's not just that they're hunkering down as individual capitalists, but that there's a systemic kind of drive towards nationalism somehow. And this is the part I don't have worked out.
Well, let me put it the way I've been thinking about it, which is to say, because I do resist the idea that Trump's a nationalist in the way that people usually understand that. In other words, I think that maybe the nationalism is inevitable in the sense that the global capitalist system now has to reorganize itself, and that the only basis for that are national states. In other words, they're actually a structural principle of global capitalism. In other words, it's not as if national states really were bypassed by international bodies. That never happened, right? They were all based on national states, and so national states are what we have to work with. And so I would say, rather than a wave of nationalism, I would describe it as that the crisis of neoliberalism poses the question of what nation states actually represent. In other words, that what the nation state represents is up for grabs. And so it's in contention. And that's why I don't think we can say it will resolve in any particular way.
Right. I guess something like the EU or even neoliberal mm-hmm. trade sort of gestures towards not a real internationalism, but a kind of internationalism that I hate to see go away, even if I don't.
It's not going to go away. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be renegotiated. In other words, like Trump didn't cancel NAFTA, he renegotiated it. The EU is not going to disappear, but it is going to be renegotiated. And Brexit is like this funny example of that, because the UK was always an exceptional member. And so basically, it was always on the fence, and the crisis was precipitated by the demand that they get off the fence. And basically, if there had not been a demand for them to get off the fence, there would have been no Brexit. If they could have just stayed on the same fence, they would have just
stayed on the fence. But the demand that they get off the fence was brought on, I think, by the economic crisis.
Yes.
The problems within the EU.
Yes. In other words, what the EU tried to do was use the economic crisis as an opportunity for greater integration. But then that just exposed the problem of the basis of that integration. And obviously the basis of that integration is not international working class solidarity.
Well, I mean, they wanted greater integration because there was a threat of disintegration.
Yes.
I mean,
there was a policy crisis.
I mean, it looked like Greece could leave. And I mean, it would have been a devastating tragedy. And it was anyway, right? But it looked like Spain might break. I mean, there was a moment there where the EU might just fall apart all by itself. So in an effort to consolidate itself, it lost the UK. But it could be that that's all that happens. It doesn't necessarily. It could mean that they could succeed in holding together as Europe. I don't know. But
right. Obama and Hollande and Christine Lagarde, like, really criticized Merkel for the draconianism towards Greece. Because they thought, you know, actually, this is sending the wrong signal. In other words, to preserve the EU, they were like, don't do this, right? Don't push austerity. And, you know, and Merkel didn't listen, and Germany dominates. I mean, that's the other thing, is that what was exposed is just how much Germany dominates. And, you know, yeah, people didn't like it.
I just, the reason why I kind of retreat into political economy all the time is because I want to look at Merkel and say, well, to what extent was it a nationalist project for her? I mean, what to what extent was it opportunistic to be that way? And to what extent was it what the political economic demands or, you know, pressures?
It was the attempt to hold what was used to be called the Washington Consensus into the Great Recession, meaning fiscal conservatism.
But the fiscal conservatism itself arose out of a crisis, you know, too. I mean, the idea there, I just thought...
A long time ago.
Right. But I mean, my thought is that what she wanted to stave off was more banking crises, another financial crisis.
Oh, yes.
If she didn't crack down on Greece, that if she were seen to be lenient around the loans, if she didn't, then... There would be more.
The whole system would collapse.
Right. So,
and she was not alone in that. In other words, like I remember there being The Economist and Wall Street Journal. Like, in other words, people were contemplating, okay, the whole Eurozone, right, could fall apart because its financial underpinnings might collapse if Greece defaults. However, it might default. In other words, it might default by leaving. It might default. It might simply default.
Or it might be allowed to default, right?
Yes.
It might be, you know, forgiven or have some sort of new payment policy worked out that everyone knows will never – the loans won't ever be repaid. And which case, all of that kind of is the same consequence. And so what they decided was, no, Greece will simply have to pay for this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Merkel was not irrational, right? In other words, at one level, it was very rational. But at another level, of course, any politician has to juggle more than one ball, meaning you can't just juggle the economic ball. You also have to juggle the political ball.
Right. But the question is, if you had juggled the political ball instead, if you had been nice to Greece, would that have, you know, set off a chain reaction?
I guess hindsight is 20/20, though. We look back now and we say, oh, it didn't happen, so maybe it wouldn't have happened, and so they could have afforded to be more lenient, but who knows?
One thing you said in your conversation with Derek Varn and Lexi is that the Marxist project is not to create Marxists, right? The Marxist project isn't to get everyone to read all the right books and become ideologically Marxists. And I definitely agree with that. On the other hand, though, I feel as though if you're not going to become ideologically Marxist, you know, first of all, you don't want to be ideologically Marxist anyway, right? That's a problem, right? No one should be ideologically Marxist. But also, if you're not going to read Marx, then other ideas that are similar or unveil the same problems should come forward, right? Like, people are going to need to understand the structure of the society they're in fairly deeply in order to overcome it.
Okay, so let's unpack that a bit. What I meant by that, you know, we need cadre. We do need ideologues. We do need propagandists. We do need, like, true believers. We do need people who have a reified, dogmatic understanding of things just to propound it and get it out there. We need vulgar Marxism that way. The problem is that even the extremely rarefied, erudite, abstruse Marxists are dogmatic, right? So, you know, in other words, we definitely need, like, I mean, I think, you know, we need a mass socialist party to take power. And you can't have that without a lot of propagandism and vulgarism and dogmatism, all that stuff. So, you know, you need different things at different levels. What you need also is self-consciousness of, you know, this is not the be-all, end-all. In other words, you need some nice, like, crafty formulations that on close inspection may not pass muster. You know, like, those who labor must rule. Right? It's like, okay, yes, but then what does that mean? Well, what it means, of course, is that you need a political party with lifetime cadre and professional revolutionaries to take power, which is not exactly the same thing as those who labor ruling. Right. And, you know, and it also doesn't mean paracon. Like, those who labor must rule does not mean that, you know, all the workers at the shop are voting on everything all the time. Right. Like, we don't need Whole Foods style, like, workplace worker participation. Like, you know, rah-rah Whole Foods. Like, we're all in this together and we're going to have our meetings after the shift. Right. In other words, that's capitalism. So, you know, again, what it means, right? And it's kind of like, well, it's got to be embodied in the program, and it's got to be embodied in the strategy and the long-term, like, goal. And, you know, what are we building towards? So we need Marxists in that sense. In other words, Marxism became a dominant ideology in the working classes movement for socialism in the late 19th and early 20th century. And that had to happen. It was fraught with problems and dangers, and it had its manifest downsides that played out later. But it had to happen. In other words, there's no way around that, right? So, you know, I am in favor of that. What I meant was a revolution in the United States will not require the majority of people to agree with Marxism ideologically. It will not. And in fact, quite the contrary, I think that a revolution in the United States, most support for socialist revolution in the United States will probably come from some kind of American patriotism. In other words, in the event, people who were right-wing will suddenly be in favor of socialism because it will look like the only way out to save America. And that's just real. Right? Like, that's how Russians supported the Bolsheviks. That's how a lot of Germans supported the Spartacus Fund, right? So, like, young Germans who were, like, in the trenches came back and became communists because they wanted to save Germany.
Right. But
and that's just real.
I mean, I don't know if I'm, you know, I disagree with you in terms of, like, the letter of the law there, right? But there's something about the spirit of it that I'm not sure I agree with.
I'm just pushing against the subculturalism of the left that imagines quite the contrary, that socialism requires people to be anti-American in the United States, and that somehow in the future the United States is just going to dissolve into its constituent multicultural parts. In other words, the Latinos are all going to become, like, Aztlan supporters, right? And blacks are going to become all black nationalists and Afrocentrics, and women are going to be all feminists. And so we're going to bring down this beast by dissolving it into its constituent parts. No, that's not what socialist revolution.
Do people really believe that just the complete fracturing of society is going to be what brings?
Yes. Destroy America. Absolutely. Bring down the beast. Like, defeat American imperialism. They do. The Spartacists themselves just had a faction fight this year in which a faction quit over the refusal of the majority to endorse giving Aztlan back to Mexico.
This is so far away from, you know, that kind of approach is so far away from what I could believe in or support. I don't even know how to react to it, but what I'm thinking...
I mean, it could happen.
Well, yeah, but it wouldn't
be socialist.
You could
have a civil war in the United States.
It wouldn't have anything to do with socialism. It would just be you know, we could become like the Middle East.
Yeah. Right? You could be balkanized. You could balkanize America. I mean, and who knows? Maybe some kind of socialism could emerge from that process. I mean, again, it's kind of like, well, anything could happen. But you know, is this really the vision?
I mean, look, the Posadists thought that we needed a nuclear war before we could have socialism, right? So,
right.
Yeah, and maybe we could have socialism after nuclear war. Who am I to say we can't? But
who knows?
But doesn't seem like the best process to me.
In other words, it gives into a kind of catastrophism. In other words, socialism can't be based on this kind of nihilism.
I agree, but my feeling is to go back to this. I feel as though socialism, when it comes, when people decide, if right wingers decide, oh, socialism is the only way forward for civilization, that would mean that to call them right wing at that point would be a mistake. that would be a transformation in them as well as the situation that they.
But it will. Socialism will come out of a conservative impulse. In other words, it won't come out of a right-wing ideology, but it will come out of a conservative impulse, namely to save society. It will be bourgeois in that sense.
Right. But we should want to save society. We, you know, not just,
yes.
You know.
Yes. Right.
I mean.
We should not give in to the Ayn Randism. Absolutely.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that when people want to save society in order to save themselves, there's an opportunity for them to come together and create a better foundation for the society they're in to realize.
So that's the support for socialism. But obviously you need a political instrument that is not just that support. In other words, you do need like a force capable of taking governmental power that will have the democratic support of the majority of people. But it's not like the, you know what I mean? Like, in other words, you need people who are prepared to take power before that, who are a minority of the population. In other words, political people. Like, obviously, most people are not political, and most people are not going to be terribly political, meaning there might be politicization in a revolution. People will become political and polarized.
But if you got elected president tomorrow, you would not be.
Me.
Yeah, you or one of them other people.
I could not do a damn thing.
Right.
Right.
You have to build a. not just because you're you, but I mean, you. Not just,
no, there's no force.
Right. There's no social base for it.
There's no instrument. There's no social base. I mean, there might be a social base, but there isn't a political instrument. You know, it's like Noam Chomsky will say that if you ask people the right way, you'll find that 70% of people support socialism.
Yeah, and if you ask them the right way, you can find 70% of people support slavery. I mean,
absolutely. Exactly right. And so I kind of feel like, well, that's true, but that says nothing about how you're going to make it happen.
Yeah, I really admire Noam Chomsky, but I feel like at this point, I don't know. I don't rely on him for political insight. I rely on him as a cataloger of U.S. atrocities.
Yeah. He's a speaks truth to power or whatever Cornel West says.
Right. But okay. So I'm going to try to get this out as more completely because I've been attempting it, and I'm just going to read what I wrote down before I called you, which is that years ago, I recorded podcasts with Derek Varn while he was a member of Platypus. And at the time, I was very curious about your organization. Like, even then, I was curious about it. And we'd been arguing at that time, if you don't remember the podcast, we were, like, debating how to get beyond nihilism, amongst other things. And you said that we were repeating the past and that the podcasts themselves were kind of a regression because Hegel had already gotten past such philosophical concerns. My response at the time was, okay, maybe Hegel has, but the audience hasn't, we haven't, and in order to get there, we have to go through the process that Hegel went through. You know?
So this is my criticism of Derek for his performance on your interview when he was a member. So this is like an internal criticism that he shared with you.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
I didn't know it that.
I don't remember it clearly, but I'm sure that I said something like that.
Right, and to be honest, yeah, so like, the way the chain went, it was a criticism that he had given of Derek and maybe his performance, which then he transformed into a criticism of both of us and really then his criticism of my project. You know, so that's how that worked out. I'm not sure that's accurate or fair.
I mean, look, any educational project, right, which any kind of public sphere kind of activity, like publishing zero books, doing these interviews and podcasts that you do, the videos that you do, which I like those two that you sent me about realizing philosophy. Like, they're very nicely done and informative and nice presentation, the little clips from films. I thought, you know, so any kind of educational project does then, you know, raise this question of, what are the ideas that are being propounded and what effect does one imagine they will have in the world? Right? And really it's the latter part. So Platypus, right, is an educational project, but of a specific kind, And we don't assume that we're the be-all and end-all. In other words, we do not assume that our approach to education is going to replace all other approaches to education. Not at all. We just think that it's otherwise missing. Our approach is otherwise missing. And our approach is negative. It's negative. And so my criticism of Derek was for going positive. Meaning, you know, which is not to say that, you know, one can't go positive. One can. But as a Platypus member, one should cultivate, you know, in other words, one could do other things also as an individual. But speaking on behalf of Platypus and also, you know, thinking of how we develop our own members, that there's a necessary place for a negative approach.
Do you feel like you've taken a negative approach in this interview?
More or less. I mean, again, like, you know, in defending myself on the Trump matter, right, I tried to kind of clarify my negativity vis-a-vis the left and the Democrats, which is obviously not to be mistaken for some positivity about Trump. And, I mean, you know, I think that, again, on the issue of philosophy itself, you know, it's very tricky, and I think it's something that you've addressed in your media presentations, which is Marxism, that there is something distorting about characterizing Marxism as an anti-philosophy, right? And therefore, though, that raises the question of, okay, what's the positive content of Marxism philosophically? And that raises the question, to my mind, of critical philosophy, meaning, well, what's the positive content of, like, bourgeois critical philosophy, Kant and Hegel? Like, what's the critical turn that's taken? And, you know, and again, I kind of feel like, well, that's not exactly the negativity. There is a way in which Platypus, of course, tries to sustain that notion of negativity, the negative labor of the concept, to use Hegel's expression. But there's another kind of negativity that we're interested in. And that negativity is precisely in how the left has consumed itself and betrayed itself and really become a kind of a new right, truth be told, since the 60s at least, but also maybe since Stalinism. Right? So the negativity there has more to do with, like, the Frankfurt School approach. So it's different from, like, a Trotskyist approach. In other words, the Trotskyist approach is kind of critical in the sense of polemics, right? In the sense of, like, you know, exposing the opportunism and the bankruptcy and the reformism of your political opponents. It has more to do with the Frankfurt School than it has to do with Trotskyism, although Trotskyists also get this reputation for being negative. And so, again, with the Frankfurt School, it's kind of like, well, the negativity of the Frankfurt School is usually misunderstood. It's usually misunderstood as either cultural Marxism, like the alt-right has this paranoia that, like, the Frankfurt School is trying to undermine Western civilization, or you get, like, this kind of postmodernist appropriation of the Frankfurt School, which is that the Frankfurt School is just exposing the hubris of reason and consciousness.
Right, right, yeah. This misread of negative dialectics of... I actually had a debate with someone on Twitter years ago. I don't know who it was, but where they just started throwing Adorno quotes at me. And I said, the way you're reading this, it seems like your idea towards socialism is that we should all just get a lobotomy. And they're like, well, maybe that mm-hmm. they said maybe that wouldn't be a bad idea.
It's Lacanian. It's the dethroning of the subject. I was on a panel years ago now with Jay Bernstein and Lydia Goer. And they are both familiar with post-structuralism and postmodernism, but they think of themselves as not that, but rather as Frankfurt School. And she chastised me on the panel. She said, well, Chris, you're making it seem like Benjamin and Adorno were saying something positive about, like, communism and socialism and Marxism, whereas really they're saying that you can't say anything positive about those things. And I'm like, no, Adorno's not Derrida. Right. This is not the, no. Right. But she really objected to my teasing out the Marxist politics of Adorno and Benjamin.
How do you need to? How do you need to tease out the Marxist politics of Adorno and Benjamin? I mean,
There's a whole generation, though, you know, that I think really did go in for the postmodernism.
So the thing about Hegel is, I think that it is worthwhile to, in thought, follow through the critique and come to some understanding of it. And that, not that every working class person will have to understand Hegel as he was originally written, but that there are some insights that should become kind of bedrock of society, you know, like in a way, like the idea that we are creating our own social conditions and we're responsible for them. That should become the same kind of insight as the earth revolves around the sun.
Well, okay. So what we're really talking about then is bourgeois consciousness and bourgeois common sense and how it might exist still, might just be there. So, you know, so I suddenly thought of, like, the other controversy that Platypus got embroiled in before the Trump controversy, which was the Iraq War controversy. And so in the Iraq War controversy, we were seen as pro-imperialist and pro-invasion, pro-occupation. And rather, you know, we just said, well, look at the Iraqi left itself, which is not to say that the Iraqi left is all that good, like the Iraqi Communist Party or the Worker Communist Party of Iraq. But, you know, they their position was that they were against the invasion and they were against the occupation, but they weren't going to prioritize a military fight against the American troops, that they were going to concentrate on things like the actual conditions for workers in Iraq under the occupation and to fight against privatization of the oil industry and to fight against sectarianism in the new government. Right?
Yeah.
And this was
That makes sense to me.
And what I was going to say is that is Hegelian in the sense of you got to deal with what's possible now. There's no point in trying to cry over spilled milk or go back and put Humpty Dumpty back together again. In other words, the whole left imagination internationally was that somehow Ba'athism was okay until the U.S. came along and fucked it up. Right? And the Iraqi left was like, look, we never supported Saddam Hussein, and we would not have supported the U.S. invasion to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but it's over and done with now, and so now what? And frankly, that is common sense. Like, that's just, you're living in reality. And if you need Hegel to explain that, which is to say, you have to deal with historical conditions as they've occurred and treat the present as an opportunity for struggling for freedom in whatever way you can.
I think that the cold response would be, from like someone like Chomsky would be, yes, I understand that the condition, well, first of all, Chomsky said a couple different things.
Right, but, right.
I mean, Chomsky didn't really say these things, but that the kind of followers of, let's say, Democracy Now would say, well, it's unfortunate that people that we've invaded and the people in Iraq are going to have to suffer. But in order to take down the American juggernaut, in order to stop this imperial machine, they
from
have
going
to
on to be to from going on to commit further atrocities in other countries. Mm-hmm.
Right. They have to be defeated in Iraq.
Yes. In other words, a kind of replay of the Vietnam War idea.
Right.
Like the two, three, many Vietnams, the Che Guevara idea. Well, again,
so,
that's...
Yeah, it's true that that will be a sacrifice for the people of Iraq.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that that was based on a misapprehension of the neocons and of the Bush administration and everything else. And it's also a misapprehension of how the Iraq War actually happened, which is to say that Saddam... his regime and Ba'athism were in crisis in a way that, for instance, the Islamic Republic of Iran was not in crisis. So, like, the neocons were like, okay, we've done Baghdad, now on to Tehran, and while we're at it, why don't we overthrow the Saudis too? It's like, but Saudi Arabia and Iran are actually not in crisis in the way that Ba'athist Iraq was.
My problem at the time when I was involved in the peace movement, I wasn't involved through an organization, was that I found the peace organization I was involved with unable to have real conversations or real debates.
You mean you can't even raise this? Exactly.
Right.
Meaning Platypus got crucified for even raising the question.
Right. And when you do raise it, it gets
as conservative.
No one will come out and say, no one will come out and say, listen, we have a revolutionary defeatist position.
Right. Well, that's true too. Yeah.
Right. So no one will come out and say what their position is. They just hold it. And sometimes unconsciously and sometimes consciously, right?
I would say consciously, but then they demagogue it and it becomes like self-determination and anti-US imperialism. It becomes very kind of conservative. And you know, my attitude about revolutionary defeatism was that, yeah, you can have a so-called revolutionary defeatist attitude, but really what you're saying is defeat the Republicans and bring in the Democrats.
Right. That is true, too. It was all in service of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And so, again, that was seen as like, you know, oh, well, that's too cynical, or, oh, well, what is this, an apology for Bush? And it's like, well, no, you know, but again, we wanted to just raise the...
At the time, there was no basis to have a peace movement support the Democratic Party. None. The Democrats had all been on board with not just the invasion of Afghanistan, which I was against, but Iraq. You know, there were certain kinds of very well-washed, 35 to 45-year-old people who were in charge of the peace organization, and they were they weren't like Democratic operatives. They were just Democrats. And it definitely was not a revolution. There was nothing radical about the peace movement.
Right. It was defeatist of Bush. And, you know, and Bush's policy could be seen as reckless and, you know, certainly risky. And you could say, you know, the neocons, like, shot themselves in the foot. I mean, yeah, Trump has come in out of the debacle of neoconservatism, too.
It's amazing that Jeb Bush had to say he thought the Iraq war was a mistake. I mean, that's just amazing to me, thinking back on it. But the thing I want to get to, though, is when you say we'll have to have a party that just works on the level of slogans, you're creating conditions where these things can't be raised within the party.
There's a history that could demonstrate. In other words, I think, you know, the old...
My experience in political organizations is that there's a big emphasis on slogans. There's a big emphasis on unity, and there's no room for actual self-criticism or just critical thinking within the organization.
So here's the thing. Okay, so there's a kind of my party right or wrong attitude, and certainly the Republicans and the Democrats have that attitude. And a socialist party would need to have that too, meaning that even if you disagree with the resolved position of the party, that you're loyal to the party. In other words, that you maintain your loyalty to the party even when you disagree with its policy. Right?
And but you have to have the space to vehemently disagree within the party.
Yes. And like I said, the Republicans and the Democrats have this. In other words, they do have that. And so, and that's, of course, their strength. And, you know, we only know sectarianism. We only know these propaganda groups. And, of course, those are not strong enough to be able to bear disagreements, really. And so what we're talking about is the need to create a party that could be strong enough to bear disagreements. And, you know,
and we don't have that.
We do not have that.
Right.
And all that I'm saying is we need to get there. And part of getting there is, of course, being clear that that's what it is. And so, of course, a kind of ideological uniformity, you know, and also just a cultural, like a lifestyle cultural uniformity is also anathema to that, you know, meaning you need to have different kind of sensibilities, you know, in other words, it needs to be understood as instrumental, meaning we're in this together for a specific purpose. We're not in this together because we all like each other and we all have the same opinion on everything. And because we're culturally uniform, you know, we agree to disagree for a purpose.